Okay, so I'm back for more of the Grimm's Fairy Tales Made Gay. We left off on how Rumpelstiltz held out in vain for a bonus. So the next one, how Jack made the giants uncommonly sore. You may hear my cat throughout this, just an FYI. She's been a little needy recently, but. All right, so just like before, this is just a cold read. How Jack made the giants uncommonly sore. Of all the ill-fated boys ever created, young Jack was the wretchedest lad. An emphatic, erratic, dogmatic fanatic was foisted upon him as a dad. And from time to time, oh, and from the time he could walk, and before he could talk, his wearisome training began. On a highly barbarian, disciplinarian, nearly Tartarian plan. He taught him some Raleigh, he taught him some Macaulay, till all the hortus he knew, and the drastic, sarcastic, fantastic, scholastic, Philippines of Junus, too. He made him learn lots of the poems of Watts, and frequently he ignored on any principle any son's title to Benson's. Till he learned Tennyson's Maud. For those of the for the for these are the giants of thought and science, he said in a positive way. So weigh them, obey them, display them, and lay them to heart into your infancy day. Jack made no reply, but he said on the sly an eloquent word that he had come from a quite indefensible, most reprehensible but indispensable chum. By the time he was 20, Jack had such a plenty of books and paternal advice. Though seedy and needy, indeed he was greedy for vengeance, whatever the price. In editor's seat of critical sheet, he found the revenge that he sought, and with sterling appliance of mind, he wrote defiance of all the giants of thought. He'd thunder and grumble at high and at humble until he became in a while mordacious, pugnacious, rapacious, good gracious, they called him the Yankee Carlyle. But he never took rest on his quarrelsome quest of the giants both mighty and small. He slated, distorted them, hanged them, and quartered them till he had slaughtered them all. And this is the moral that lies in the verse. If you have a go farther, you're apt to fare worse. When you turn it around, it is rather different. It's different, rather. You are not apt to go worse if you have a fair father. Okay. Now, this one is how rudeness and kindness were justly rewarded. Once on a time, long ago, just when I quite forgot, two maidens lived beside the Po, one blonde and one brunette. The blonde one's character was mild, from morning until night she smiled, whereas the one whose hair was brown did little else than pine and frown. I think one ought to draw the line at girls who always frown and pine. The blonde one learned to play the harp like all accomplished dames, and trained her voice to take C sharp as well as Emma Eames, made baskets out of scented grass and paperweights of hammered brass, and lots of other odds and ends for gentlemen and lady friends. I think it takes a great deal of sense to manufacture such gifts for gents. The dark one wore an air of gloom, proclaimed the world a bore, and took her breakfast in her room 3 mornings out of 4. With crankiness she seemed imbued, and everything she said was rude. She sniffed, she sneered, and what is more, when very much provoked, she swore. I think that I could never care for any girl who learned to swear. One day the blonde was striding past a forest all alone, when all at once her eyes she cast upon a wrinkled crone, who tottered near with shaking knees and said, "A penny, if you please." and you will learn with some surprise that this was a fairy in disguise. I think it must be hard to know a fairy who's incognito. The maiden filled her trembling palms with coinage from the realm. The fairy said, "Take back your alms, my heart they overwhelm. Henceforth at every word shall slip a pearl or a ruby from your lip." And when the girl got home that night, she found the fairy's words were right. I think there are not many girls whose words are worth their weight in pearls. It happened that the cross brunette 10 minutes later came along the self-same road. She met that bent and winkled dame, who asked her humbly for a sow. The girl replied, "Get out with you." The fairy cried, "Each word you drop, a tone out of your mouth shall hop." I think nothing accommodates one's speech like uninvited toads. And so it was the cheerful blonde lived in joy and bliss, and grew punctious beyond the dreams of Adverse, that must be it. Just a quick Google, I promise. Okay, it's extreme greed for wealth or material gain. Okay, I think it's
Avarice.
Okay, we all learned that today. And grew penunctious beyond the dreams of avarice. And to a nice young man was wed. And I have often heard it said, no other man who ever walked most loved his wife when she most talked. I think this very fact, forsooth, goes far to prove I tell the truth. The cross brunette, the fairy's joke, by hook or crook survived. But still at every word she spoke, an ugly toad arrived. Until at last she had to come to feigning she was only dumb, whereat the suitors swarmed around, and soon a wealthy mate was found. I think nobody ever knew the happier husband of the two. Okay, there's a bit of French here again. But, okay, the moral of the tale is, blah. Nous avons changé tout cela? No clear idea, I hope to strike, of what your nicest girl is like. But she whose best young man I am is not an oyster or a clam.
Oh, pardon my yawn.
I'm getting a little warm. Okay, so next one. How Beauty contrived to get square with the beast. I believe. All right. Miss Genevieve Platt was so beautiful that she couldn't remember the day when on one of her swains hadn't taken the pains to send her a mammoth bouquet. And the postman had found on the whole of his round that no one received such a lot of bulky espadrilles as waiting his whistles the beautiful Genevieve got. A significant sign that her charm was divine was seen in society when the chaperons sniffed with their eyebrows alift wherever's got into the men. There was always a man who was holding her fan at 20 that danced in details, and a couple of mourners who brooded in the corners and gnawed at their mustache and nails. John Jeremy Platt wouldn't stay in the flat for his beautiful daughter he missed. When he'd taken his tub, he would high in his club and dally with poker or whist. At the end of the year, it was pretty clear that he'd never computed the cost, for he hadn't a penny to settle the many of tens of thousands of dollars he'd lost. A Ferdinand Fife was a student of life. He was coarse and excessively fat, with a beard like a goat's, but he held all the notes of ruined Jeremy Platt. With an adamant smile that was brimming with guile, he said, "I am took with the face of your beautiful daughter, and wed me she otter to save you from utter disgrace." Miss Genevieve Platt didn't hesitate at her duty's imperative call. When they looked at the bride, all the chaperones cried, "She isn't so bad after all." Of the desolate men, there were something like 10 who took up political lives, and flower of the flock went and fell off the dock, and the rest married hideous wives. But the beautiful wife of F. Ferdinand Fife was the wildest that ever was known. She'd grumbled and glared till the man didn't dare to say his soul was his own. She sneered at his ills and quadruples his bills, and spent nearly twice what he earned. Her husband deserted and frivoled and flirted till Ferdinand's reason was turned. He repented too late, and his terrible fate upon him so heavily sat that he swore at the day when he sat down to play at cards with John Jeremy Platt. He was dead in the year, and the fair Genevieve in society sparkled again. With chaperones fluttered, their fans, they marveled, "She's getting exceedingly plain." All right. The moral. Predicaments often are found that beautiful duty is apt to get round, but greedy extortioners better beware, for dutiful beauty is apt to get spare. Square. Okay. How a fair one, no hope to his highness accorded. She has slid down the channels of history's annals, disguised as the child of a king, but that is a glib, an iniquitous fib, for she was never such a thing. They called her the fair one with golden locks, and it's true she had lovers who swarmed in flocks. But the rest is ironic. Her business chronic was selling hair tonic by bottle and box. From the dawn till the gloaming, she used to sit combing her hair in a languorous way, and her suitors would stop and look at her, look into the shop, and stand there for the rest of the day. She'd fill them with mute but with deep despair, for she would never glance up with a smile to wear. They stood about crushing each other and blushing. She simply kept brushing her beautiful hair. But a prince who was passing, engaged in amassing some facts on American life, was suddenly struck by the fact that his luck might give him that girl for a wife. His rashness he didn't attempt to excuse. He entered the shop and he stated his views, remarking, "My jewel, I'm confident you will not wish to be cruel enough to refuse." "Most winsome of creatures," he told her, "your features had led me to candidly say that no other best would I have for a bride will be married a week from today. I belong to a long and titled line, and the least of your wishes I wouldn't decline. Next month I will usher my wife into Russia. Sweet comber and brusher, consider your mine." She looked at him squarely, considered him fairly. Her glance was as keen as a knife. Then she turned up her nose, and with icy repose, she answered, "Well, not on your life. You're not on the paper, the only blot. Do you think I come 12 in a parcel, what? Me pose as your dearie, oh, go and chase Peary, you're making me weary now, get." He got. The crowd that had waited outside was elated so much by the prince's mischance that they greeted with jeers and ironical cheers the end of his little romance. They said, "Did it hurt when the ground you hit?" And they searched for some mark where the prince had lit. And as he grew colder, they only grew bolder and tapped on his shoulder with, "Tag, you're it." The lengthy discussion that sensitive Russian compiled on the USA was read by the maid as she carelessly played with her beautiful hair one day. The talk you hear in that primitive land, he wrote, nobody can understand. Somebody who guffed him, she said, has stuffed him and easily bluffed him to be the band. The moral. The people across the brine are exceedingly strong on auld lang syne. But they are lost in the push when they strike a gang that is strong on American new line slang. Okay. How Thomas a Maid from a Dragon Released. Though Philip II of France was reckoned no coward, his breath came short when they told him a dragon as big as a wagon was waiting below the court. A dragon so long and wide and so fat that he couldn't get in at the door to chat. The king couldn't leave him outside and grieve him. He had to receive him upon the mat. The dragon bowed nicely and said very concisely, he stated the reason he called. He made the disclosure with frigid composure. King Philip was simply appalled. He demanded for eating a fortnight apart the monarch's 10 daughters, all dear to his heart. And now you'll produce, he concluded, the juicy and succulent Lucy by way of the start. King Philip was pliant and far from defiant, and servile, no doubt, you retort. But if you struck a snag on a bottle green dragon who filled up 2/3 of your court, and curled up his tail on your new tin roof, and made your pizzazz groan under his hoof, would you threaten and thunder, or just knuckle under completely? I wonder if I put it to proof. By way of a truce, he brought out Lucy and watched her conducted away, but all of the others were out with their brothers, thus gaining a little delay. He promised through heralds sent west and east his crown and his kingdom, and last, not least, his daughter so slightly to anyone knightly who'd come and politely wipe out that beast. For love of the charmer arrayed in his armor, each suitor for glory who yearned would gallantly hasten to the dragon to chasten, but none of them ever returned. When the dragon had eaten some 16 score, he hung up this sign on the cavern door, where he lay pronely in majesty lonely, their standing room only for 3 nights more. A slim adolescent, his beard only crescent, rode up at the stage of the game to where the old sinner lay gorged on his dinner and breathing out torrents of flame. He gathered a tip from the flaunting sign and took his position, the 4th in line, until, as foreboded, Byfoon incommoded, the dragon exploded at 9:30. The king was delighted at first when he sighted the victor, but then in dismay regarded his promise. The stripling was Thomas, his majesty, valet de paix. He asked him at once, will you compromise? But Thomas looked straight in his master's eyes and answered him severely, I see your game clearly and scorn it sincerely. Hand out the prize. Not long did he linger before on the finger of Lucy he fitted a ring. A month or two later, they made him dictator in place of the elderly king. He was lauded by pulpit and boomed by the press, and no one had ever a chance to guess. Behold this hero who ruled like a Nero. His valor was 0 or something less. The moral. And still from Nice to Calice, oh, it's probably Nice to Calice, discretion's the better part of valets. fellas. I think I might end it there. Yeah, I think I'm going to end it there. It's about 20 minutes and a bit more through the Grimm's Tales Made Gay. So there you are. Some more funny fairy tales.